WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a man who has accused reality of having a liberal bias, Stephen Colbert. On his Comedy Central show, The Colbert Report, Colbert has the persona of a conservative pundit who believes science is elitist, NPR is 39% sedition, and if the Constitution says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, maybe we need an executive order to do it. We'll talk with Colbert about his show and his new book, I Am America and So Can You. Stephen Colbert, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen Colbert delivers his truth to the nation on the Colbert Report, and today he's going to lay some of that truth on Fresh Air. The occasion is his new book, I Am America and So Can You. What Jon Stewart's Daily Show is to news, the Colbert Report is to conservative punditry. The shows are on back-to-back on Comedy Central. Colbert got his start in fake news as a reporter on The Daily Show. Here's the opening of last night's Colbert Report.
Tonight, Rush Limbaugh is criticized for his comments about soldiers. If only he had some way to kill the pain of these attacks. Then Bush vetoes children's health care legislation. Hey, if kids want health care, they should become congressmen. And my guest George Saunders says TV news commentators are making America shrill and divided. I'll tell him, you're welcome. It's Columbus Day, but I won't rest until all the state capitals are recognized. This is the Colbert Report.
Stephen Colbert, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have you here. I'd love to have you do a reading from your new book, I Am America and So Can You.
Okay.
And this is from the chapter called Homosexuals.
So how did this happen? Where did all these the gays come from? Well, there are those who argue that some people are born gay, but this is just silly because we are made in God's image. So if someone were born gay, that would mean God is part gay, and he is definitely not. He is 100% hetero. God is all man. Now, the man-huggers out there are saying, Mary, please, what about the Iraq War? Surely that's a bigger threat than gay marriage. Yes. Iraq is the central front on the war on terror, and we're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. But consider this. Who other than terrorists wants to destroy our way of life? The gays. Allowing them to marry would be like strapping on a suicide vest with a matching cummerbund. When I married my wife, she became Mrs. Stephen Colbert. Likewise, I became Mr. Stephen Colbert. We went from being two autonomous individuals to a team whose sole focus was winning the game of life. By winning, of course, I mean procreation. And we have won. We have procreated. And I mean no disrespect to those readers who have not had children. There is no shame in being a genetic dead end.
That's really great. That's Stephen Colbert reading from his new book, I Am America and So Can You. How in the world did you have time to do this book and a CD version of it? I remember the last time you were on the show. And you were talking about how you were trying to make the show less about the character and less scripted. You said it was an unsustainable level of script output and that your head writer had been there 4 a.m. writing. And you've not succeeded in that one thing. The show is not less about you. Unsustainable level of writing and of you-ness. And yet you've added to that with all the stuff. Do you know what your children look like anymore?
I do. I have a sketch artist come in every so often and give me renderings of what they look like now. What are there parts of your body you're not supposed to bleed out of? Because we're all undergoing some unusual symptoms over at the show, and I don't know if you're a licensed medical practitioner, but we still work really hard on getting the show out every day. And the book was on top of that. We had a really, from last September, essentially, until the end of May, we worked on the book, and then very intensely from Christmas to May. And we had some really fun, intense shows in that period of time. And we wrote the book at night, and we wrote the book on the weekends. And I don't entirely know how we did it. You sort of get into a zone where adrenaline is pumping through your body, and I would call Jon Stewart, or he would call me and say, are you okay? I know you're writing a book at the same time. And I would say, I don't understand. I'm not tired. I feel fine. And then the day the book was over, he wrote me a really nice long letter saying, look, I want you to prepare yourself for what it's going to feel like to not work 24 hours a day. Because he had the same experience with America, the book. And it was actually much tougher to not write the book. It's been tougher since the beginning of the summer when the book's been done to not work 24 hours a day because you get addicted to the adrenaline.
Well, you know, one of the things you've done is challenge the New York Times liberal economics columnist Paul Krugman to a duel over your book. And I want to play that excerpt.
It's very much like Fitty and Kanye.
Right. You referred to the Fitty and Kanye a feud about what, who was going to sell more records?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so let me play this excerpt from your show, The Colbert Report.
The title fight is coming up 1 week from today, Tuesday, October 9th, when my book, I Am America and So Can You, drops in bookstores wide. Now you're probably asking, who has the balls to release a book the same day as Stephen Colbert? Well, it's New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. Apparently, yeah, indeed. Apparently, he wasn't happy with the 22 books he's already written. I say, you make the first one good enough, you don't have to write another. And I never will. If you're not familiar with Krugman's work, he's the author of such illuminating editorials as All the President's Enablers, Department of Injustice, and A Gay Marine Should Marry Your Only Son. It was a bold stance. The book is called The Conscience of a Liberal, so I assume it's a pamphlet. Or maybe it's a bookmark to put in the Communist Manifesto while you and the other members of your drum circle go outside and hug a piece of grass. Krugman, you have been on my show. I gave you the Colbert bump. Let me put this in terms a writer for the New York Times will understand. Paul Krugman, or Paul, betray us. Here's the deal. If your book outsells mine, I will stop doing my TV show. But don't worry. But if I outsell you, you have to eat your precious liberal conscience, symbolized as it was for Pinocchio by a cricket.
That's Stephen Colbert from his show, challenging Paul Krugman. So what happens if Krugman sells more books than you? I know that's probably unlikely to happen.
I stopped doing my show. That's it.
I don't know if you were watching Bill O'Reilly a couple of years ago when one of his books came out, and he was doing the same thing with Hillary. Hillary had had a book, and he was basically saying, this is a battle in the culture wars, and if she sells more books, then they win. But if I sell more books, then we win.
I actually did not know he did that.
Yes,
that's fantastic.
He did it. He did it many nights.
Wow, so I emulated his behavior just with our imagination. That's fantastic.
You're there. You're in the zone.
I'm in the no-fact zone.
Feuds have become very important to you, feuds and challenges.
Yeah. Well, I take everything personally. My character, there's nothing too large that doesn't involve him. Every news story is really about him. As you know, as we said when we first started the show, is that, you know, everything he cares about is a news story because he cares about it, no matter how petty and in his life, or no matter how large that can't be reduced to something in his life. And so, yeah, everything gets very personal. And that's what culture wars are about. They're very personal because it's all just opinion. Culture is a series of agreed opinions. And so, of course, it's got to get personal.
Now, your new book is written in persona. How has your relationship to your alter ego changed in the past couple of years now that, like, you've done the show, you know, a lot? You know, like when you were starting it, you had to like figure out who that character was and flesh him out. But now you've
lived
that character.
Right, when we first started it, it was, well, you know, it's an amplification of the character I did on The Daily Show, who even then was a, you know, as I said, a well-intentioned, poorly informed, high-status idiot. And then we said, well, let's pick some specific models. So we picked guys like Bill O'Reilly or Anderson Cooper for his slickness, or Sean Hannity for his just bullet-headed incuriosity. And we thought, okay, well, I'll be kind of tied to these guys. And obviously O'Reilly is the greatest. He's the king, so he's the clearest figure for any of that. But then as the show's progressed, we've done things like the green screen challenge, or we've done trying to get a Hungarian bridge named after me, or challenging Sean Penn to a metaphor off, or Willie Nelson to an ice cream off. And those things really aren't political. They're really not – they're not something O'Reilly would necessarily do. And so I've found that at the base of it is still that character from The Daily Show who is well-intentioned, poorly informed, high-status idiot that I can apply to other issues.
Well, one of the things now is that we're facing the possibility of going to war with Iran. And that's one of the things you've been talking about. Do you feel like you have like a real role now in the debate, like through humor, you know, about what's to happen in Iran?
I have no role in the debate. I really don't. I don't think anybody pays any attention to what satirists do. For all the media criticism that goes into the idea that young people get their news from us, I think, listen, people who actually make decisions don't pay any attention to what people who have real ideas say. And why would they listen to something that we say or even the influence that we may or may not have over a young generation? I just don't buy that we're a legitimate part of the debate. I don't want to be part of it.
My guest is Stephen Colbert. He has a new book called I Am America and So Can You. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Colbert, and he has a new book now and an audio version of the book, and it's called I Am America, and So Can You. Now, I haven't seen Better Know a District for a long time. Better Know a District is when you have on usually a lesser-known congressman and do an interview with them, and you explain the last
time. We would do better-known congressmen if they would talk to me.
Exactly.
But that's always been a problem, yeah.
Right, and you explained the last time on the show that you did Better Know a District because the only politicians willing to come on the show were lesser-known congressmen. But are they not willing to come on now, too? I mean, wasn't there like a directive from like top
Nancy
Democrats?
Pelosi gave a directive to Democrats not to come on my show, not to do Better Know a District, and that it actually didn't work all that well. She gave the directive, you know, a year ago, and we've done a ton of them since then. And then after the election, when the freshmen came in for the 2006 class, Rahm Emanuel, who it was, you know, their scoutmaster, said no freshmen go on my show, but even they did. You know, we managed to corral a bunch of them. I don't know. We're having a real dry spell right now. I think something like Robert Wexler, who said on camera that he enjoys prostitutes and cocaine because they're fun to do. I think it's got people skittish, but I don't really understand why. Because
you told him to say that.
I said, you know, would you be willing to say this? And he said it. And there was no trickery. There was no editing. He just said it. So that's the sort of thing that any congressman really could prevent themselves from doing by saying, no, I prefer not to say that. But we still have congressmen who are willing to talk to me. Actually, when we were writing the book, I had no time to talk to them. So hopefully the congressmen who are still willing to talk to me, we can get to this fall. And then, you know, re-encourage the rest of Congress to not see me as some sort of assassin, but as more of, you know, I'm a comedian.
But it shows you are having some kind of impact if people are afraid to come on the show and talk to you.
Not the impact you really want for a talk
show. Not the impact
they
really want, apparently.
Exactly.
I love the way you incorporate bad things that happened to you on your show, like when you broke your wrist. You had such great bits after that, the movies with wrist violence and the red bracelets for wrist awareness.
Well, that's a pure expression of what I was talking about before, is that anything that he cares about is news.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sees this one thing that happens to him as, well, it's a sign, you know, of what's going on in the larger culture. And my wrist became part of the culture war, that this is what Hollywood does. They glorify wrist violence. And we made that blanket statement, and then lo and behold, there are tons of movies that glorify wrist violence. I guess it's an easy special effect to achieve, to show a broken wrist. There's a fantastic one in The Fly where Jeff Goldblum nearly rips a guy's hand off in a arm wrestling match. Oh, we got a lot of mileage out of that.
How soon?
But it's different. That's no different than, you know, O'Reilly, you know, playing any kind of culture clip.
How soon after you realized you broke your wrist and you were in pain did you think, I know we can make this work on the show?
Leaving the doctor's parking lot. in the summertime, there's not much to talk about because Washington is really out of session and the president is on vacation. And, you know, the end of the summer, the story was the war and the continuation of the war and what are the statistics of the war and how will that inform Petraeus's testimony on, you know, on September 11th and September 12th. About whether we should continue the surge. You know, that's all that we're talking about. And that ends up being tragic statistics for a month. And we just couldn't go on noodling around that. And so we were looking for, like, what is something that could be large enough in my life that would occupy my mind during this time. And I had broken my hand early in the summer and didn't know it. I'd broken my wrist and didn't know it. It had just gotten puffier and puffier and worse, and then finally I said, I got to go. I was pretty sure it was broken, but I didn't want to give in to having a broken wrist in the summertime. And so I went to the doctor. He goes, it's broken. So he wraps it up. He puts the cast on it. And as I leave the driveway, I thought, this is a life-changing experience for my character. This is a real wake-up call. And it needs to be one for America. And I called on the way in. I called our booker. And I said, see who you can get to sign my cast. I'm going to be in D.C. tomorrow to do a Better Know a District. See who you can get to sign my cast while I'm down there. And it turned out to be a lot of people in D.C. were willing to sign my cast.
Didn't Nancy Pelosi sign it?
Nancy Pelosi signed it. And
so she won't let guests on your show, but she'll sign your cast.
Right. As she said, and when she signed it, I still won't be a guest on your show. I still won't come on your show. And I said, well, I think you are right now.
Well, there was this great video on your show, you know, of you falling in the warm up to your show and breaking.
That was real. I wanted to know. A camera happened to be on, and it really is like a Zapruder film, from my character's point of view. You know, I realize there's nothing is more important than what happens to him. It shows me running around the studio because I was just I kind of get the audience's energy up, so they realize this is not a news show; it's a comedy show. And I ran around my desk, and I always take this leap off of the podium that my desk sits on and leap out toward the audience and high-five them. And I just – it was the day before the book was due.
Oh,
and I was
no.
so tired. Oh. And all I think was, God, I have to – I literally – I'm going to stay up all night proofreading the book, making sure it's all done. And I said, well, I'll just go out there and just with all the energy in the world. But I had no more muscle control than you normally would. I was so exhausted that I just went, my feet came out from underneath me and I left the screen and the frame is still and I leave frame like I'm on an invisible gurney, just absolutely sideways. And then I landed on my wrist and got to the other side.
Were you embarrassed when you fell and was there part of you thinking, well, Patti Smith fell off a stage, these things happen?
I thought of myself as Anne Margaret. No, I wasn't embarrassed at all. It's very hard to be embarrassed if you do what I do for this long. I was in a tremendous amount of pain. I actually thought I'd shattered my hip.
Oh, God,
and,
really?
And for a moment, it hurt so much the way I landed. I thought maybe I'd shattered my hip the way an old woman does, where, like, the hip breaks, then she falls.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was so calcium depleted from writing a book and doing a show for the last 9 months. I thought, this is it. I'm rotting from the inside. And that's why I fell down. And I crawled into the front row and lay across four people in the front row. And they were so sweet. They pet me while I lay there and moaned. And the best part is I had a mic in my hand. So I was just going, I have a book due tomorrow. Oh, are there any questions?
Did you do the show after that?
I did. If you watch that show, it's like June 27th or something. My hand's underneath the desk for most of it because I have an ice pack down there.
Were you in pain or did adrenaline like?
I was in tremendous amount of pain, Terry. The courage it took to go on at that moment, I think, is something that my children will be able to look to and say, yes, Dad did this. I was in a little bit of pain.
So you did some really funny things about being addicted to painkillers where you just like take a bottle and pour it down your throat.
Yeah.
And chew it. And
yep.
Especially since...
That was coming at a nice time because there were several starlets who were having problems at that moment.
Oh, well, and there was Rush Limbaugh's problems too, of course, in the not-too-distant past.
Not-too-distant past, no. Hopefully he's kicked that. I don't want his hearing to go away again. Do you imagine how much drugs you would have to take for your hearing to go away?
Oh, is that what he said, that his hearing's went away?
He started to go deaf. That was the first warning sign, because if you take too much Oxycontin, you lose your hearing.
Oh.
And he got all this sympathy for having gone deaf. And it turns out that if you just lay off snorting the prescription drugs, your hearing comes back. Maybe he was blowing it in his ear. I don't know.
So, but you probably had to take some painkillers.
I took, my doctor prescribed a generic painkiller called, and I kid you not, called flurbiprofen. Flurbiprofen, F-L-U-R-B-I profen. And I thought, this has got to be a joke. This has got to be a joke. Can you imagine, like, committing suicide with flurbiprofen and having your loved one call the poison control center and going, he's taking all the pills. Ma'am, what is it? Tell us what he's taken. We need to know. Is flurbiprofen? Okay, ma'am, this is not a joke line. Click.
Stephen Colbert will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called I Am America, and So Can You. Here's an excerpt of the Colbert Report when Stephen Colbert got his cast taken off his broken wrist. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
So it is time to take it off, and here's the only man for the job. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome 5'11" of solid diagnostic power. Nation, I give to you America's preeminent sawbones, my doctor, Gerald. Jerry, good man. Thank you for coming on. Now, before we get into this, should I take a painkiller?
No.
All right, fair enough. Now, Dr. Vizzone, tear down this cast.
Go for it.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From MGM, presenting Lars and the Real Girl, a heartfelt comedy starring Ryan Gosling, now playing in select cities, starts Friday nationwide. And from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Stephen Colbert tells us about satirizing President Bush at the 2006 White House Correspondents' Dinner when the president was seated just a few feet away. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stephen Colbert. His program, The Colbert Report, is on Comedy Central, right after The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. What Stewart is to fake news, Colbert is to conservative punditry. Colbert has a new book called I Am America, and So Can You. You know, we were talking about O'Reilly and how he started off as one of your role models for your character. I just want to play a brief clip of when you were on O'Reilly's show and then he was on your show.
I better like this clip, Terry, or I will cut off your mic. Are you clear? This is your show, but I know a lot of people in broadcasting. All right, watch it.
All right, so this is an excerpt of O'Reilly on the Colbert Report.
Please welcome Papa Bear, Bill O'Reilly. Bill! Welcome, sir.
Thank you. You hear that booing?
No, that's not. That's booing? Not booing. That's the bear caller going. They're going, boo, Papa Bear.
No.
No, that's ooh,
that's,
Riley.
That's booing. That's Stewart. That's John Stewart in that plaid shirt.
No. I have a restraining order against John Stewart. He's not allowed in the building.
He's jealous. He's jealous of you, Colbert.
The man is a sexual predator. That's why I had to leave, Bill.
Yeah.
You have no idea what that's like.
I thought it was so amazing that you did that because you're saying about he was a sexual predator and Bill, you have no idea what that's like. And of course, everybody knew that O'Reilly had been accused of sexual harassment at that point.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I thought that was so brave to do that. I mean, so because it's like taking that kind of satire to somebody's face. Was it hard to actually do that in the room with him to his face?
The entire interview was hard. I was expecting him to come on in his persona from the show, but he immediately dropped it. We cut out almost 2 minutes of that interview because he dropped it so fully that there was really, the game was completely gone. And I didn't want to just attack a human being. I just wanted to have a tennis match with his public persona and he dropped it. So we ended up. We had like a 7.5-minute interview, and if you time it with a stopwatch, and I know a lot of my viewers do, that was shorter than a normal interview on our show. I don't think he necessarily. You'd have to ask him, but I don't think he enjoyed facing a doppelganger.
It must have been pretty odd for him, and he was saying to you things like, you know, that's just a character. I'm really nice. I'm a really nice person. That's just an act. And then you said.
Well, if you're an act, then what am I?
Yeah, I thought that was such. Was that just like an improvised line?
Well, yeah, I was just startled that he would come on air and say that he doesn't mean the things he says. And I think he was joshing to deflate a moment, but it was surprising.
My guest is Stephen Colbert, and he has a new book and a new audio version of the book, and they're called I Am America, and So Can You. Now, we've been talking about things that have happened that were bad in your life and making them work for you, and under that category is losing the Emmys 2 years in a row, first to Barry Manilow and then to Tony Bennett. And you had so much fun with that.
You know what? I think at this point that I think my real enemy is the Great American Songbook. I'm most upset at Ira Gershwin.
Yeah.
And Irving Berlin. Those are the guys who really piss me off at this point because they're the ones putting the words in the mouths of these people. It is amazing to lose 2 years in a row to great American song stylists.
Well,
is why I've got to do a special. I've got to do my own Stephen Colbert and Friends special.
Well, this is the closest you've come to it so far. You did a duet. You invited Tony, just as you did with Barry Manilow. You know, you invited Tony Bennett on the show, and after comparing his strengths to yours as a performer. But anyways, you invited Tony Bennett on the show, and after your interview, he sang, and then there was a little surprise. So let's hear an excerpt of that, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
They all laughed at Rockefeller Center. Now they're fighting to get in. They all laughed at Whitney and his cotton gin. Laughed at Fulton and his steamboat, Hershey and his chocolate bar. Ford and his Lizzie made the laughers dizzy.
Tony, that's how people are. They laughed at me. You said it would be hello, goodbye. But boy, you came through. Now they're eating humble pie.
They all said we'd never get together.
Bravo, sir.
Thank you. I know, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a golden statue or to be able to sing for 2 minutes with Tony Bennett? I'd say I won. I think I say I won that one.
Oh, yeah. Who chose the song? You or Tony Bennett?
He did.
Did you know the lyrics already?
I knew the song. I didn't know the lyrics. And I wasn't actually, I kind of wanted to sing with them. And then we were so just, you know, every day is like a mad rush to get the show done. And this was no exception. And he came on and they said, you know, if you're going to go sing with Tony, you got to go down there right now. And I said, I'm not going to do it. I just can't. There's no time. And so I got to go say hi to him. So I went down there to thank him for coming on because I'm a longtime fan. And he said, so I understand that you want to do a song with me. And I said, yes. Yes, I do. You know, I tried to demur for just a minute. Like, what am I saying? Tony Bennett's willing to do a duet with me. I'd be an idiot to not say yes. And we noodled around for about, you know, 15 minutes as to when I would jump in. And then we're like, that's the right plot. That's the right
spot. Perfect
spot.
Right there. Perfect spot. Yeah. My guest is Stephen Colbert. He has a new book called I Am America and So Can You. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Colbert, host of Comedy Central's Colbert Report. He has a new book called I Am America and So Can You. The book includes a copy of his famous 2006 address to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, in which he appeared in character and satirized President Bush, who was seated just a few feet away. Here's an excerpt from the opening of Colbert's speech.
Wow. Wow, what an honor. The White House Correspondents' Dinner, to actually, to sit here at the same table with my hero, George W. Bush, to be this close to the man. I feel like I'm dreaming. Somebody pinch me. You know what? I'm a pretty sound sleeper. That may not be enough. Somebody shoot me in the face. Is he really not here tonight? Damn it. The one guy who could have helped.
Now, I have to ask you about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That was, I mean, that
Do
was...
Do I have to answer?
Well, that's in your hands.
Okay.
That was such an act of comedy and bravery. I mean, you were at a table just a couple of seats away from the president, and then you had to walk a few steps over to the microphone, and you really took the gloves off. I mean, you said some really...
I would say I put the gloves on. Uh-huh. I put the comedy gloves on.
Okay.
You know, like one thing that we always make sure is to always keep the gloves on.
Not really make it personal, like, make a comedy.
Yeah, because it'd be very easy to do, and I think the satirists can fall into this, is to get angry about the things that you're talking about or to get, you know, emotional about what you're talking about. And the job is not to come in the morning and have a shout fest over, can you believe this thing that's being done? Or can you believe what's being ignored or what's being purported to be the truth or what particular moment of BS that is so redolent in the air that's not being sniffed? You can do that at the morning meeting, but that's not your job. Your job is then to take what happens in that morning meeting and then take the next 6 hours to distill that into something that's comedy. And I would say those are the gloves. You put the comedy gloves on and people allow you to throw punches at them or to receive the punches at home because you've got the gloves on. If you just took the gloves off, then it would be too harsh all the time.
I want to play a brief excerpt of what you said that night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner with the president sitting just a couple of chairs away. Mm-hmm. And so here's a little excerpt.
The greatest thing about this man is he's steady. You know where he stands. He believes the same thing Wednesday that he believed on Monday. No matter what happened Tuesday. Events can change. This man's beliefs never will.
That's pretty funny, and that I think that cuts pretty deep. Did you have any sense before you got onto stage what it would feel like to say this kind of thing with a lot of Bush administration people in the audience and the president, you know, just a little more than an arm's distance away? Like, was it hard to actually do it?
saying the words was pretty easy because I really liked all the jokes, and I got to, you know, there's the pit that you're walking over of, well, are the people who I'm doing this kind of thing for going to like it or not like it? That's the pit of fear that's below you. But I felt like I had such a solid bridge of jokes that I had no fear in walking across it. It, you know, it's difficult. It takes sweat and it takes stick-to-itiveness in focus as a performer to do the whole thing in character and to keep driving forward in moments of silence. Though I have to say, you know, people say that it bombed in the room. There were 3,000 people in the room. And it's an enormous room. And, you know, when it bombed over, like, if you hear the recording, you go, boy, nothing, no one's happening there. 1,000 people are still laughing. But they're laughing in the back of the room. They're not laughing up by the president's table and where the mics are. And so for me, at the center of 1,000 people laughing, that still feels pretty good. You didn't really get a sense that I'm tanking. You never really had that sense up there. You had a sense like, well, that one worked better. I kind of like that, maybe that more than that response got. But you never got a sense that something's wrong. I don't really think anything was wrong, but I didn't get a sense that there was anything particularly different about it until I sat down and people were conspicuously not meeting my eyes.
Oh, and leaving the table. A few people seemed to flee the table after you sat down.
The evening's over. The people around me, the evening is over at that moment. But I don't know, maybe I had sort of a vaguely radioactive quality at that moment. I don't know.
The president patted you on the back and kept walking.
He said, well done.
You couldn't hear that on mic. But then after nailing the president, you nailed the press. And I think they weren't expecting that. And I want to play a short example of what I mean.
But listen, let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction.
Do you think that the press was expecting that you'd be criticizing them too? And what reaction did you feel from the room when you said that?
I know what, I don't remember. I don't remember. It all felt very much of a piece to me in terms of the reaction. It all felt very much the same to me. The thing that I remember afterwards is I tried not to read much reaction about it afterwards. And I know there was a lot of reaction, but... it didn't help me to pay attention to it, so
I read
one really negative one and one, you know, pretty positive one, and then I read a couple people's blogs, and then I cut off. That was literally the Monday that we got back from Washington. After that, and then I said, okay, nobody send me links. I can't do this. But in the negative one, the person criticized me for, you know, letting the press off. And I thought, gosh, the whole, like, the last
ten minutes, exactly.
I think, was just about, the last 10 minutes was just about the press. So I don't think people paid as much attention to that because I was standing next to the president and I was doing satire about him and the policies of the administration. That's all people really remembered about the evening.
What do you think the odds are that the president knew or was at least briefed about the Stephen Colbert persona? Do you think he had any context for how to take what you were saying?
I don't know. I mean, beforehand, he said, it's nice that we can do this. And I said, yeah, it's an honor to be able to do satire in front of you. And we had a little conversation about that. So I don't think he was completely unaware
of
who I was.
The other thing that must have been strange for you is that you use that character in the context of your show. It's a controlled environment. The audience has come to see the Stephen Colbert show. They get it. They know what the show is. And suddenly you're out in this ballroom of 3,000 people where probably a lot of them have never seen your show.
Yeah.
And had no idea what the heck was going on.
I think that was very, very much part of it, is that people expected stand-up. And I don't do stand-up. I admire stand-ups, and it's a very difficult thing to do. But I don't. I do this character. I do character work, and I started off in improvisation doing characters at Second City in Chicago. And so I think they expected, you know, 20 minutes of jokes as opposed to the sort of a performance piece. And not their fault. They didn't care for it. I never want to blame the audience, but I think you're right. I think people were a little bit surprised.
My guest is Stephen Colbert, and he has a new book and a new audio version of the book, and they're called I Am America, and So Can You. How old were you when you started getting interested in theater?
My mother had wanted to be an actress, and so I heard about that growing up. And I was in high school, I suppose. I was pretty much an outsider. I was a nerd and not really accepted by my peers. And, played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. And there's a role-playing aspect to that. You know, it's fantasy role-playing. And then I found out that I could tell stories in an improvisational way. And I started hanging out with a couple of the cooler kids who liked having me around because I told jokes and I was silly and I did pratfalls and kind of being a class clown is a classic thing. A class clown got me accepted by a broader array of kids. And I kind of thought I'd be a comedian when I grew up. And it wasn't until I got to college and got all depressed, which a lot of college freshmen do, I suppose, got a lot of personal angst that I thought, well, no, not comedy, you know, tragedy, because the world has to see how I feel all the time. And then I held the infant of my tragic career to my bosom for years until I met some people who worked at Second City and I thought, no, I'd rather do this.
Did you ever go through like a heavy rebellion period where you kind of, you know, broke off with your mother and
because some viewers would know that when I was a child, my father and two of my brothers died, and it was just me and my mom alone in the house for years, and so we ended up becoming like friends, as much as we were mother son. You know, my mother was sort of deeply struck, you know, sort of shattered by the event of my father and my brother's death, and so we joke and say that I raised my mother, because I was there alone with her. And so I didn't have the same kind of rebellion because there was this sort of shattering event at an early age that sort of changed the dynamic of the relationship. Not that she wasn't the boss and not that I didn't learn from her, not that she wasn't sort of the moral figure, but the order of the world didn't make as much sense to a child anymore. And so I didn't really feel like I needed to rebel that much. I had a teenage rebellion, like I smoked dope and didn't do my homework, but nothing too dramatic.
Gee, I think you can't run for president or be on the Supreme Court having just said that.
Oh, can't I? I will make sure you eat those words someday, young lady.
You have three kids.
Well, now, I could just say I said that in character, Terry. Could have been my character talking just now.
Gets you off the hook.
It sure does.
You can say anything and say it was in character.
All kinds of things on my character.
So, you know, you satirize religious extremes so much in your show that a lot of people assume that you're not religious. But, of course, you know, you're Catholic, you go to church, you're raising your children in the faith. What do you tell them about God? Like, what do you tell them God is?
That's interesting. I don't know if any of them has asked me what God is. I've taught a couple years of CCD, Sunday School Catechism. And I think the answer that God is love is pretty good for a child because children understand love. And, you know, I don't want to get too much more complex than that with a second grader.
Yeah, but then there's like the plagues and stuff.
well, there is the plagues. There is the plagues and stuff. My son asked me one day, Dad, what's hell? You know? And I think at first I asked, why do you want to know? Because I wanted to know whether somebody had condemned him to hell. And he goes, he heard the term and he wanted to know what hell was. And so I said, well, you know, if God is love, then hell is the absence of God's love. And, you know, can you imagine how great it is to be loved? Can you imagine how great it is to be loved fully, to be loved totally, to be loved, you know, beyond your ability to imagine it, you know? And imagine if you knew that was a possibility. And then that was taken from you and knew that you would never be loved. Well, that's hell, to be alone and know what you've lost. And that's the best I could do.
My guest is Stephen Colbert. His program, The Colbert Report, follows The Daily Show on Comedy Central, and he has a new book called I Am America, and So Can You. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Colbert. His program, The Colbert Report, is on Comedy Central. His new book is called I Am America, and So Can You. You know, you're getting so much attention now because of your show and, of course, because the new book is out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a cover story on you in Parade magazine. And
Yes, there was.
And there's a picture of you in like a pinstripe suit and angel's wings on the cover. And the headline read, "After childhood tragedy, comic Stephen Colbert learns you've got to let go." And inside it said,
After tragedy,
TV funny man Stephen Colbert says, if you are laughing, you can't be afraid.
Yeah.
And I thought, with all due respect to that article, and it was a really interesting article, the headlines kind of package things in just the kind of way that you'd satirize.
You know, when I saw it, I thought, I hope someone perceives this as a very dry joke. But unfortunately, there's no punchline in it. I don't generally talk about my personal life. I try not to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the article was just fine, and I had a very nice time. The interviewer was just a capital guy. We had a really nice conversation. But I made the mistake of answering questions about my life that I normally don't. And so that's the price you pay. That photo on the cover, by the way, was supposed to be part of a composite photograph. It's supposed to be me in the same suit with an angel on one shoulder and an angel on the other shoulder, because my character would never admit to having a devil. And they only used the angel photograph and gave it that particular title, which is, it's their prerogative, but it's certainly not what we intended, myself and the photographer, the artist, when we made it.
What's next after the Colbert Report, Stephen Colbert version? What do you see when you look into the distant future? Is there another kind of performance that you want to do at some point?
I'm an actor, sure. I'd like to do something else, but I really like what I'm doing right now, and it asks of me everything I know how to do,
Which
is to perform and to write and edit and produce. And, you know, if I want to, I could sing a duet with Tony Bennett. And so it's hard for me to imagine what I would enjoy more.
Heck, you get to ask Henry Kissinger to be a judge on the Countdown to Guitarmageddon. I mean,
you know, there was something that we wanted Dr. Kissinger. He was one line. I thanked him for trusting me with his dignity, you know?
Right, yes.
But there was one line he wouldn't say, because we were trying to figure out, why would Henry Kissinger do this? So we need to come up with a justification as to why Kissinger showed up to do this. So we wanted to go back to him and say, Dr. Kissinger, is there anything you'd like to say? And we wanted him to say, where are my pancakes? I was promised pancakes. And he wouldn't do it. I did a full court press. And somewhere there exists the recording, because I did it on camera. There's a recording of me trying to convince Henry Kissinger to say the lines. But we just couldn't get him to say it.
So I get to do
things like that, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I just want to say, I love it when you insult NPR.
It's my pleasure.
Or as you describe it in the book, Nancy Pelosi radio or Nazi Palestinian radio. And you have this great pie chart of the content of Morning Edition.
My character finds it offensive that NPR doesn't have to compete in the general marketplace with actual radio. As it says here, what's wrong with NPR? Just listen to Morning Edition. This is by far the least zany morning zoo ever to hit the airwaves. Instead of the get-up-and-go-larity provided by your local Scott and Tom or Ted and Zeke or Denise and Santana or Coyote Mike and the Beamer, Morning Edition presents NPR's measured barbiturate vibe. And then it has a content of Morning Zoo and content of Morning Edition, two different pie charts. And then, you know, the 57% of a Morning Zoo is sound effects or prank calls. And 39% of Morning Edition is sedition, wry essays by New Englanders, and the color light gray.
Oh, and 15% glowing descriptions of fundraising gift mug.
And the balance is just word jazz.
Stephen Colbert, thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me back.
Stephen Colbert's new book is called I Am America, and So Can You. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with the guy Colbert lost an Emmy to, the great Tony Bennett.
In a mellow tone, feeling fancy free, I am not alone, I got company. Everything's okay, the livelong day, with this mellow song, I can't go.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment, presenting Rain Over Me, starring Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle, now on DVD and Blu-ray High Def. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Still confused about the subprime mortgage meltdown and the role of hedge funds? We'll hear some explanations from Gretchen Morgenson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. She says, we're in the eye of the storm. It's not over yet. Join us for the next Fresh Air.